The next case this morning is 520-284 People v. Hickman. Arguing for the appellant James Hickman is John Hanlon. Arguing for the appellee People of the State of Illinois is Hiram Fenjack. Each side will have 10 minutes for their argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note only the clerk is permitted to record these proceedings.
Good morning, counsel. I've been telling everybody this morning, I apologize for not wearing a robe. I'm in downtown Chicago helping with the new judge orientation. But thanks to Zoom, I was able to participate this morning. Mr. Hanlon, I believe, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm hoping you can hear me.
We can.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, I am.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court. And good morning, Your Honors and counsel. I'm John Hanlon, appearing on behalf of my client, James Andrew Andy Hickman. My client was convicted of first-degree murder at a bench trial after the tragic death of his two-month-old son, Evander, in November of 2018. The primary issue on appeal, Your Honors, of course, pertains to the insufficiency of the evidence put forth at the bench trial, specifically as to the act and mens rea requirements of the murder statute. To this day, there is no judge, prosecutor, attorney, no one, doctor, who can point to any specific act that occurred that could be attributable to Mr. Hickman toward this child. And that's the majority of what I'd like to spend my time on. Your Honors, before getting into the evidence at trial, I think I would point out that the uncertainties in this case, the uncertainties began at its very outset. Mr. Hickman, and this is in evidence, Mr. Hickman was arrested on the way back from the hospital, the way back to his home, after leaving the hospital after his son's death. I refer to this as a rush to judgment in this case, that he was arrested immediately after leaving the hospital. And then the initial charges were filed just 2 days after the child's death. Those charges alleged murder by the shaking, quote unquote, shaking of the child. Approximately 4 months later, however, after the prosecution had that much further time to speak with the doctors, to investigate lay witnesses, and to do other investigation, and amended information was filed, which led to shaking or striking of Evander. So this case, if anything, at that point had become more uncertain to them 4 months after it was first charged. And I understand that charges are amended, of course. This is not an uncommon thing, but again, the case was charged. The man was arrested before he even got home after leaving the hospital where his child had died. They had months to investigate.
Counsel, how long was the child in the hospital before death?
Yeah, just a matter of days, Your Honor. A matter of days. And the uncertainty continued to the very end of the case in the circuit court when the judge, in denying the post-trial motion's claim that no act had been proven, stated, and it's on page 35 of my brief, Your Honors, the judge stated, in rejecting the post-trial motion claim that no act had been proven, if you read this, and obviously you have, but again, a very close reading of this is the judge saying, I don't know what happened. We just don't know. What the judge said was, we're never going to know exactly what happened. But in my verdict, I found that something did happen. The appellate court is going to have to review this evidence and find whether a reasonable trier of fact could have come to the same conclusion as I did. It sounds like the court, this seems like hardly a resounding or a compelling statement of findings of the actus reus element of any crime and Mr. Hickman's guilt. The failure of the prosecution to prove the act requirement for this charged offense is indeed a primary claim of this cause on appeal. And again, I would emphasize to this day, I don't think anyone, medical, legal, whomever, could say that they know what happened to this child. It just wasn't introduced. So,
Your Honor, to that counsel, you've got what I would say dueling medical theories, medical experts that testify. And obviously the court did say, we don't know what happened, as in we don't know how the injury was sustained. But that medical testimony and that evidence, I mean, that's certainly circumstantial evidence that a trial court can consider when making its ruling, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, I understand. And I was just about to start to talk about the medical, so we're having similar timing thoughts. This was not a case, first of all, just context, again, as to the medical. This was not a case where there was a confession, nor was there an eyewitness, nor was there any object that might do harm to a child found anywhere of relevance. And so the state's case did come down to the medical. I don't think there's any question about it. And the problems there were several. First of all, Your Honors, none of the medical witnesses, until the rebuttal witness, but none of the state's case-in-chief medical witness testified to findings beyond a reasonable degree of medical certainty. Now, I've taken time in my brief to discuss what that means. I mean, you all and I have done depositions where that term comes up. I think it's more of a civil term, but maybe it should be applied in criminal cases. Well, I don't think so, but arguably, maybe it should. It wasn't here. None of the witnesses testified that their findings were made within or beyond a reasonable degree, or even within a reasonable degree of medical certainty. One of the state's experts, Dr. Swofford, was never even qualified as an expert, and thus never expressly even permitted to state her opinions. Dr. Swofford then testified that she thought that the injury had been inflicted for the reason that no one had given her any history of accident. Now, this is a murder case where my client is doing a 38-year sentence, and a doctor got on the stand and testified that, well, I think the injuries were inflicted because nobody's told me otherwise. That can't be the standard. That just can't be the standard. So perhaps most importantly, Your Honors, that the testimony of each of the medical witnesses was so thoroughly couched in uncertainty. And I've in my opening brief on page 33, I've kind of summarized that. We have words from the medical experts, and again, it's on this chart that I laid out on page 33 of the opening brief. Dr. Bond said that there was some kind of suspicious head or brain problem with Evander. Dr. Hodge testified to her concern, quote unquote, that Evander had a serious brain injury, said that those injuries could be accidental, but was suspicious and concerned that they were not. Dr. Goyle told the court that similarly, that Evander's injuries presented a highly concerning situation for abusive head trauma. Dr. Swofford, as I said, was not even qualified as an expert witness. And most significantly, though, as to Dr. Swofford, was her acknowledgement that she found that this was a non-accidental injury, only because no one told her otherwise, gave her any history of anything otherwise. Dr. Ely, E-L-Y, who was the pathologist who performed the autopsy, had no idea whether Evander had been shaken or struck, nor could she say that the closed head injury was inflicted, intentional, knowing, or anything else about it. is this enough in a case of murder where these doctors are so, and I've talked a lot about the apples and oranges, that the tension that exists between the medical world and its terms and the legal world and its terms. But again, none of these witnesses even said to a reasonable degree of medical certainty or neuropathological certainty or any other level of certainty. And then I've seen that my time is going to expire, but just very simply, the state argues in its brief that the appellant cannot point to any alternative person or event that could have caused these injuries. And I would remind the court that there's evidence that a woman stayed in the house that night with Mr. Hickman. There's no evidence that there was anything going on between them, but this is a friend of both the mother of the child and Mr. Hickman. She stayed in the house even though the mother of the child wanted her gone. But she stayed there nonetheless. Yeah, there was someone else in the house. And Mr. Hickman provided an alternate explanation, that of, I gave my child a bath and he slipped out of my hands. He said that story several times to the police and others. And again, Your Honors, I'd love to come and discuss this more. This is so important, but I see my time is up. So thank you, Your Honors.
Well, and obviously, counsel, you'll have your time for rebuttal, but I just want to ask, and pardon me, I don't have access to my briefs, computer, whatnot. As far as Dr. Swofford being qualified as an expert, was there any objection from defense counsel of her testimony or her qualifications or anything such as that?
No, Your Honor. Again, this is this litany, this parade of medical experts. And again, this is my reasonable supposition, is that after you see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, some of those details start to fall off. Oh my gosh, she was never qualified. But the answer to your question, as I recall, is no.
Okay. Well, thank you. Justice Welch or Justice Moore, do you have any questions at this time?
No questions.
No.
Okay. Mr. Finjack, you're on mute. So once you unmute, go right ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. Well, I would just like to say that in a case like this, where you're questioning the sufficiency of the evidence, it's really comes down to the fact finders, the one that's given the deference in reaching their decision. So as long as any rational fact finder could have reached the conclusion, verdict should be upheld. And in this case, the court heard numerous medical experts testify. The evidence established that the child was completely healthy during his 2 months that he was alive. The afternoon that he was brought over to stay with his father, he seemed completely healthy. There were no issues. Medical evaluations and autopsy revealed that the child had suffered, it's called the triad subdural hemorrhaging, retinal hemorrhaging, and traumatic axonal injury. And this is believed by a lot of medical experts that it is caused by a rapid deceleration, acceleration of the child's head. There are other opinions as far as the validity of shaken baby syndrome or abusive head trauma, as it's called now. But the court heard the medical evidence. The court heard the defendant's experts. He had the opportunity to put on the countervailing theory as to what caused the injuries. And the defense's experts actually contradicted each other. I believe it was Dr. Scheller theorized that he didn't believe the injuries could be caused by blunt force trauma by the fall, by falling, as the defense's theory is, when the child slipped, that may have caused the injuries. He thought Dr. Scheller believed it could have been SIDS that then caused a reperfusion injury that resulted in the massive brain damage that occurred to the child. He also thought it could be a blood clotting issue. The defense's other expert witness completely contradicted each one of those theories. He felt that it could have been caused by falling, slipping from the defendant's lap and hitting his head, and did not believe that SIDS or a blood clot would be the cause of the injuries. And the judge, you know, heard all of the various medical testimony, and he was in the best position to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses and come to the conclusion that he did. And as far as the defense counsel, when we say that the defendant wasn't, we're putting the burden on them to explain what happened. The fact is that so much of the medical evidence indicates that these injuries were caused by something violent, some sort of violent motion that had happened. Likely the injuries were occurred very close to when they began to manifest. So that would put the occurrence of the injuries in the time frame when the child was alone with his father. So the state's position is basically that his story about Evander slipping from his lap, that's not a credible explanation for these injuries. And the defendant has repeatedly denied that the child even hit his head, that he caught him before he did. And then he changed his statement at some point that the child may have struck his head when he slipped. Defense counsel argues that it's understandable that the person in this position would want to not admit that they had dropped their child and caused these injuries, which doesn't make sense, because he was being accused of intentionally injuring his child, causing his death. The defendant would want to, if it was an accident, he would want everyone to know that, but he continued to claim that the child never even hit the floor. So we're not saying that they have to prove, it's the state's burden to prove what happened, but there is no logical explanation for how these injuries could have occurred, given the medical evidence, given the time frame, and given the nature of the injuries, that the injuries would have been caused by some sort of violent motion. And as one of the justices said, that the whole argument about the act, I mean, the state does not have to and the judge noted this, the state does not have to prove the precise manner by which the defendant caused the injuries. You can circumstantially establish that it was some sort of violent act that caused it. So defense's argument about the act requirement, the failure to prove the act requirement, we don't believe is a strong argument. The medical evidence indicated that it was caused by some sort of violent trauma and that it occurred very shortly before the child went into a coma and subsequently succumbed to the injuries.
Wasn't the evidence about the time frame, about the infliction of the injuries within a narrow window?
Yeah, the various medical experts, some of them testified it could have been within 12 hours. One of the defendant's experts testified it could have been, I believe, 70, could have occurred 72 hours prior.
Was there any evidence that the baby was in the care of any other person other than the defendant during that time?
No, there wasn't. The defendant had a roommate at the house, but there was no evidence that there was any interaction between her and the child. And so I would just say that in conclusion, the court heard all the competing medical testimony. Court was in the best position to judge the credibility of the medical experts, competing medical experts. The evidence was more than sufficient to establish guilt, and certainly not insufficient to the extent that no rational trier of fact would have found the defendant guilty.
Well, thank you, counsel. I'm making a note here. Before we move on, Justice Welch or Justice Moore, do you have any questions?
No questions. No.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hanlon, go right ahead with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe it was Justice Moore, Your Honor, who just asked about the time frame of the injuries. I would highlight to the court the testimony of Dr. Eli, who was the pathologist in this case, the person who actually performed the autopsy, which the state put forth as one of their witnesses. And Dr. Eli testified that trying to provide a date for an injury is not a precise science. Logic, I think, tells us that as well. And it's only a rough estimate. Dr. Eli initially testified that this injury could go back 24 hours, as much as 24 hours. I'm sure that the concept of lucid interval is one that the court has become familiar with over the years. Dr. Eli testified that this could go back 24 hours. Then the prosecutor, this is not a critical term, but the prosecutor badgered Dr. Eli at great length in this transcript, and got Dr. Eli to ultimately say, well, most likely it'd be less than 12 hours. So, but nonetheless, Dr. Eli, the main point is, Dr. Eli said, this is not a precise science, and this is only a rough estimate.
Under the 24-hour time frame that you're suggesting, was there any other person that had the custody of the baby?
Yes, Your Honor. The baby's mother, Mr. Hickman, had the child for approximately 12 or 13 hours. So yeah, the child was brought to him that evening late afternoon, evening of the day before. And then this happened at the child was unresponsive at 5 a.m. So this that a roughly 12 to 13 hour time frame. So 24 hours, yes, 24 hours. Other people were with the child. The mother was with her friends. She had stayed elsewhere for a couple of days. That you know they stayed separate for a couple of days. And so yeah, who knows who the child is with besides the mother and other as well as other people. So yes, sir. The answer is yes. And then Dr. Goyal, G-O-Y-A-L, testified, and this is the neuroradiologist, testified that the head trauma occurred recently, quote unquote, and that the bleeding had to occur within hours, days, or a few weeks at most. Dr. Goyal's testimony, I think, gives rise to what Dr. Eli had said, that this is not a precise science. This is a rough estimate. And again, even if these injuries, very tragic, needless to say, even if this happened within the 12 hours, I mean, I think if we look at this, look, the most likely explanation, Your Honors, is that his story to the police was true. He dropped his child. And the child hit the floor, and he was too afraid to admit it. At the time he told that to the police, the child was not yet dead. He didn't know what the consequences of it. He was obviously hoping that there would be no extreme consequences to his child. But I just urge the court, I know you will, give that part a fair reading. And it's like, you know, this seems to be most likely what occurred. Counsel for the prosecution here said that this is up to the fact finder. It's up to the fact finder. But the problem here, again, Your Honors, is as you read the comments of the judge in ruling on the post-trial motion, the court, it's essentially my fair interpretation of this, trying to be as objective as I can, is that the court says, you know, I don't know. Something happened. I don't know what, but I'm going to, you know, the ball is going to get tossed to the appellate court here to figure out if my interpretation of the testimony is fair. I mean, the court, as I said, this is not a resounding, strong finding that, yes, this man did this crime. So, Your Honors, I appreciate your time. Thank you. Thank you. I ask that the court reverse this conviction of Mr. Hickman.
Thank you, counsel. Before we finish with this matter, Justice Welch, Justice Moore, do you have any questions?
No questions. No.
Okay. Well, this case actually concludes our oral arguments today. So the court will stand in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:00.